This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com and broadcasting and cable, filling in for Terry Gross. 40 years ago today, Martin Luther King was assassinated as he stood on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. He was 39. He was in Memphis to support the striking sanitation workers there, as part of his Poor People's campaign. The day before he was killed, King made his final speech, in which he referred to the Good Samaritan story in the New Testament. In the story, Jesus talks about a man who was accosted by thieves on Jericho Road, a dangerous road for travelers. A Levite and a priest passing by on the other side didn't stop to help the man. The person who did was a Samaritan, a traveler from an ethnic group that was looked down upon. Here's Martin Luther King in Memphis the day before he was killed.
You know, it's possible that the priest and the Levite looked over that man on the ground and wondered if the robbers were still around. Or it's possible that they felt that the man on the ground was merely faking. And he was acting like he had been robbed and hurt in order to seize them over there, lure them there for quick and easy seizure. And so the first question that the priest asked, the first question that the Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by, and he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? That's the question before you tonight. Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to my job? Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to all of the hours that I usually spend in my office every day and every week as a pastor? The question is not, if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? The question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question.
Martin Luther King, recorded April 3, 1968. We'll hear more later about the strike that brought King to Memphis. First, we'll hear from Taylor Branch, the author of an acclaimed trilogy chronicling King's life and the civil rights movement. The first volume, Parting the Waters, won a Pulitzer Prize. When Terry spoke with Branch in 1998, after the publication of the second volume, they discussed King's frustration in early 1963 when President Kennedy refused to issue an executive order abolishing segregation. Terry asked Taylor Branch why King chose Birmingham, Alabama, as the place to wage his struggle against segregation.
Well, I think he picked Birmingham as they called it the Pretoria of the South. It was an iron and steel town in Alabama that was had many for many decades competed with Atlanta as the premier city in the South, and it was a tough town. It was very segregated, and it had in its police commissioner Bull Connor a kind of a symbol of opposition to integration, a symbol of segregation, and so they wanted to in effect take on the toughest target and say, if we can crack segregation here, we can crack it anywhere. Of course, the flip side of that is that it was the most daunting and fearful target, and many people believe that they were quixotic in the extreme to the point of suicidal to try to challenge segregation in its stronghold there in Birmingham.
There were teenagers and children on the front lines of civil disobedience in Birmingham. How did they get there?
They got there essentially by progressing down the age chain as the movement in Birmingham sent many, many people to jail and tried to marshal the conscience of the country and failed. And after, I would say, about 6 weeks of campaign there, when several thousand people had gone to jail and Dr. King had written his letter, famous letter from Birmingham jail, there was almost no national response. And the movement facing surrender, and they were actually preparing for surrender to focus on voter registration instead of these challenges to downtown segregation, they decided out of desperation and amidst ferocious debate to lower the age that they would accept demonstrators down through junior high and even into elementary school, so that when the real breakthrough occurred in Birmingham in early May, 1963. They had children going to jail and being hauled off to jail and fire hosed as young as 6 and 7 and 8 years old in huge numbers.
And you say that the reason why the children were fire hosed and the dogs were police dogs were turned on them was in part because the jails were already full. So the idea was to, like, disperse them, get them out of there.
Yes, and that occurred time and time again. That the irony here was that the people who put Bull Connor and his police commanders who used the fire hoses and the dogs really saw themselves as doing something that was charitable, or at least the most humane way. They assumed that they could frighten the children away. When they heard that out of the church doors for that day's demonstrations were going to be not college students or high school students, but elementary school students and very young ones, they assumed they could frighten them away and, with the hoses and the dogs as a way of keeping them out of jail. But, of course, what they didn't reckon on was that the spirit of the movement had grown so strong by that point that when the kids were confronted with these big policemen and the dogs, they just kept right on marching, and the authorities then turned the dogs and the fire hoses loose, which made for riveting television and pictures on national television, and finally did kind of melt the heart or rivet a national audience to the point of that it was the big breakthrough in the civil rights movement, after which it was impossible for it to recede without making some gains, I don't think.
Taylor Branch, speaking with Terry Gross in 1998. 2 years after King's Birmingham campaign, he went to Selma, Alabama to lead the March to Montgomery in support of the Voting Rights Act. The march was chronicled in the final volume of Branch's trilogy on Martin Luther King, At Canaan's Edge. Branch writes, quote, "Selma will engage the world's conscience, strain the embattled civil rights coalition, and embroil King in negotiations with all three branches of the government," unquote. Terry spoke with Taylor Branch again in 2006.
What was the reason for planning the march from Selma to Montgomery?
It was to win the right to vote for black people in Alabama, which was a plan that had come to King. Of course, the movement had been struggling for the right to vote from the very beginning in the 1950s in many forms, including Freedom Summer in Mississippi. But this particular plan came to King from two young people on his staff, Jim Bevel and Diane Nash, who basically stayed up all night on the night of the Birmingham church bombing in 1963, crying and wringing their hands over the death of these four children and vowing that by morning they would come up with a plan to answer it on their own as citizens. And they came up with a plan to try to paralyze the state of Alabama with a nonviolent army until it granted the right for black people to vote. And that was essentially the blueprint for the Selma movement.
And what happened on the first attempt to make that march in March of 1965?
March 7th, 1965, 600 black people from Selma and surrounding rural counties started to march 54 miles from Selma to Montgomery to present a petition to George Wallace. This is after 2 months of demonstrations in Selma. And they got across the Edmund Pettus Bridge over the Alabama River and were blocked on the other side by Alabama state troopers and mounted kind of sheriff's possemen, and who drove them back in a cloud of tear gas and truncheons and beat them across the bridge in what became known as Bloody Sunday, and caused a crisis in national politics, but certainly in the civil rights movement.
Now, you write that Governor Wallace and his deputies debated a suggestion to let the march go forward unmolested, and basically this was a scheme to set a mouse trap for Martin Luther King. What was the trap they were thinking of setting?
The mouse trap option was simply to bluff like they were going to block the march and then let it go through and open the highway and let them go, because Wallace's people knew that between Selma and Montgomery there was 54 miles of some of the most forbidding country for black people in America, including Lowndes County, which lay between Selma and Montgomery, where no black person had voted in the 20th century, even though they were some 70% of the county population. and that it was a county notorious for lynching and brutality, and they thought that the marchers would not be capable of marching 54 miles, and that especially if they thought they were going to be blocked, they wouldn't be provisioned. And their plan was to open the road, but then not let anybody on the road to resupply them, and essentially maroon them out in hostile Klan country, and calculate that they would then limp back into Selma in failure. But they ultimately rejected that plan.
But on a subsequent attempt to make this march, the troops kind of cleared the way for King and the Marchers to go, and King didn't know what to make of that, and he didn't know what to do. What was this about?
Well, on the night of Bloody Sunday, March 7th, King put out a nationwide call for people to come and try to march again, so as violence couldn't stop the movement. And only 2 days later, they made the second attempt that you're referring to. But by then, there were hundreds and hundreds of people had come from all over America on almost no notice. So there was a whole host of people. Now it's an integrated group of several thousand people with King at its lead. And the federal government has, in the meantime, issued an injunction ordering King not to march until the federal government held a hearing and a court held a hearing over whether or not this was should be a protected activity and what the rights of the state of Alabama were and what the duties of the federal government were. And so the federal government privately interceded with King, telling him not to march. People in the movement felt they had to march. There were tremendous rivalries. People were at one another's throats about whether they should march federal government or not. And King faced very difficult decisions all night about what to do. And, of course, nobody knew what Governor Wallace was going to do, whether he was going to try to repress this march as well or not. But ultimately, he did order the troopers blocking the march when this host went forward, which was an integrated host with a lot of prominent politicians as well as clergy and students. And they opened the march, and King went across the bridge far enough to say that he had marched and a little past where they were, but then when they opened the way, he turned around and went back. And some people lost faith in King permanently, but it was about a very fundamental issue, which was what is the best political strategy for this movement to keep going and enact what became the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And King felt that by marching halfway and back, he was basically doing the best he could to preserve the momentum of his movement, but also his relationship with the federal government, which was going to have to enact this law.
So was King more afraid of what the troopers had in store for him or of the injunction from the federal government against the march?
He was afraid of losing his alliance with the federal government if the federal government had to put him in jail for the first time and say he had blocked a federal injunction. He knew it would make it almost impossible for President Johnson to introduce a voting rights bill, which was his ultimate goal, to establish the right to vote by law. President Johnson did decide to go before the well of the Congress and propose the Voting Rights Act in a historic speech, and that's the speech where he closed by saying, "We shall overcome," which was an odd, jaw-dropping moment in the well of the House. Many people thought they would never see any president, let alone a Southern president, say, adopt the slogan of the civil rights movement to enact a major piece of legislation. And within a day after that, the federal judges ordered the federal government to protect the march. So after much, much drama, political drama, all of which raised the profile of this effort to march through Klan country with nonviolent, unarmed people, the march took off a third time 2 weeks after Bloody Sunday on March 21st, and a great host marched 54 miles into Montgomery, ending on March 25th when King gave the speech right under the dome of the Alabama Capitol, at the foot of the Capitol, how long, not long, about the meaning of the Voting Rights March.
Taylor Branch, speaking with Terry Gross in 2006. He's the author of an acclaimed trilogy examining Martin Luther King's life and the civil rights movement. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2006 interview with author and historian Taylor Branch.
Well, King and LBJ, you know, kind of agreed on civil rights. I mean, LBJ wasn't out there in the streets with Martin Luther King, but, you know, he was an advocate, finally, of civil rights. But King and LBJ were opposed when it came to the war in Vietnam. LBJ escalated the war. King opposed the war. How did it affect their relationship to disagree so strongly about Vietnam?
It destroyed their relationship, but it destroyed their relationship in a almost in a haunting and respectful way. Johnson apologized for the war to King, but I don't think that he distorted his view. Johnson wanted anything he could do to avoid the war. He hated the war. I think the record pretty clearly shows that there was no argument that an anti-war person ever made against the Vietnam War that Johnson didn't think of first and probably agree with. He knew from the beginning that stalemate was likely and that lots of bloodshed was likely to produce no satisfactory result, but he did it anyway because he said, otherwise they'll call me a coward and run me out of office. King knew that. He knew Johnson didn't want to do the war, and he also felt that Johnson's commitment to civil rights, since after all he consciously surrendered the South from the Democratic column and said, I'm giving it up for my lifetime and future ones, to the Republican Party, and that he was consciously changing the partisan structure of the United States, that he was genuine about civil rights. He felt that Johnson made a terrible mistake, a tragic mistake about Vietnam, knowing that he was doing it, but King felt sympathy for Johnson to the point that he always said, I have never criticized Johnson and even used his name. He never, in all of his criticisms of Vietnam, he never said, this is President Johnson's war. He never said, Lyndon Johnson is wrong. He said, I have never called the president's name. This is our war. Our country is doing it. And I'm not going to blame it all on one poor Texas school teacher.
What was the reaction within the civil rights movement to Martin Luther King's opposition to the war in Vietnam?
The major civil rights leaders like Whitney Young and Roy Wilkins criticized Dr. King, said he should stay out of foreign policy. They were loyal to the Johnson administration. Some others felt that he didn't go far enough in criticizing the war and welcomed his criticism. The reaction that hurt Dr. King the most was the reaction of the major news organizations, the editorial boards of the New York Times and the Washington Post. Kind of the established opinion said he should stay out of foreign affairs and stick to race relations, which is what most senators and congressmen said, that he disgraced himself and that he should stay in race relations. Those opinions hurt Dr. King the most because he felt they were essentially denying his right to speak, segregating his citizenship.
Here's an excerpt of King's speech, Beyond Vietnam, which he delivered on April 4, 1967, at the Riverside Church in Manhattan. Laying out his arguments against the war in Vietnam, he said he had seven reasons for bringing Vietnam into the field of his moral vision. His third came out of his experiences working in the ghettos of Chicago.
As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our home nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problem, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed and the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, For the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our bonds, I cannot be silent.
An excerpt from King's speech Beyond Vietnam, delivered on April 4, 1967, 1 year before King's death. Terry spoke to Taylor Branch in 2006. More about Martin Luther King from another guest in the second half of the show. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.